Major Arthur Flint, reel 5. Major Flint, you were saying on the other reel about the change of battalion to the change of name.
Yes.
To
yeah. Well, we were the 22nd London Armoured Car Company. They decided that they wanted reinforcements for the Royal Tank Corps, and that we would become a battalion of the Royal Tank Corps, and we became the 22nd Battalion Royal Tank Corps. We lost our armoured cars. The first camp was 35, I think, yes, 35 at Lulworth, and we actually had our armoured cars at Lulworth, but after that we didn't. And we went to Lulworth and saw around the gunnery schools at Lulworth and generally learnt as much as we could as individuals about tanks and guns and so forth, which we could see. It wasn't a pucker individual training course. Oh, hold it for a minute. Yes, as I was saying, it wasn't a pucker individual training course. It was more an acclimatisation course as far as we could go. I don't recollect doing any firing down at Lulworth. I think we might have done, but I don't recollect doing any. I have fired at Lulworth, obviously, but that was later, but I don't recollect it on that particular year. We also went to the AFV school at Bovington, had a look round there. We also saw the, which was interesting, the Tank Corps Museum, which consisted of a few old First World War tanks, more or less derelict in a field and covered up with some very antiquated tarpaulins. It's now, of course, quite a magnificent place down at Bovington. But in those days, it was nothing more than these old derelict things in a field, and quite a small museum in one of the huts. Our training, of course, from then on changed at Elverton Street. They installed what was known as a RIPER, and if you've met a RIPER, rocking, yawing, and pitching apparatus. And it was a tank, a mock-up tank with a turret on it, and the turret was didn't have the armour plate round it, but it had all the bits and pieces that went into a normal tank turret, and you could traverse it, and the movement of the platform rocked and so, and just like the movement of a tank. Now, they had ordinary armament, main gun and machine gun, in the turret, but on top of it was an air rifle. And this air rifle was TNA'd or sighted on the spot where the telescope hit, or the telescope was aimed, and it fired onto an enormous sand table. And they had little tanks moving backwards and forwards, towed by wires and so on. And if you had your gun properly sighted, you would A, hit the tank, or it would hit the sand and throw up a spurt, look like a shell burst. A very fine piece of training equipment. We had one of those at Elverton Street. And, of course, our weekend training was done at Aldershot, Farnborough, Pinehurst, and we drove tanks, light tanks and medium tanks around driving courses. It was known as over the jumps, quite an exciting experience, particularly in a light tank, and it was like two bumps or a ditch with two banks, and you drove up the one bank and the tank practically stood on its tail, and you came over the top of the first bank and down into the ditch, and the tank literally stood on its nose, and you had to take it up over the next bank and down. And the first time you did it, you thought, you know, you're going to topple over, but after a bit of practice, it was quite fun. And we did a lot of that. Our sort of gunnery training that year, what I remember of it, I'm almost sure it was still done with armoured cars at Ash Ranges. I don't remember doing any tank firing until the war, so we obviously didn't do any of that sort. I forget just how that was worked.
Were you pleased to have tanks?
Oh yes, yes. It was an advancement. They cut out a lot of the armoured car companies in the Royal Tank Corps. You see, the Indian ones were done away with. and came back again and formed into, either joined the Pucca tank battalions. Originally it was 1, 2, 3, 4 battalions of the tank corps, and, five, that's right, 5th tanks at Perim, and they formed a 7th and 8th just before the war.
Did the, what type of equipment did you have? What was this tank?
Well, the tanks that we had were the light tanks. There was a range of light tanks, Mark 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6. There was a 6B and a 6C. The only difference between a 6A and a 6B and a 6C, the original 6 had Vickers machine guns in, and the others had the Beezer machine guns in. As far as our training was concerned at Elverton Street, instead of having the ordinary Mark 1 Vickers on a tripod, we had Marks 4 and Mark 6 Vickers, which were the tank weapons, and they were slightly differently designed to the original Mark. You loaded them differently and so on, but the training, went on in those. We did a lot of sand table work. We did the weekend training, and that briefly was the difference in the training. We then appeared togged up in black overalls, the Pucca Tank Corps black overalls, which you may not have seen. It looked something like today's battle dress, but was the origin of the origin of the battle dress. The battle dress, you might say, came from it, or came from something like it. A very comfortable thing to wear.
Did your technical training change now that you'd got these...
Well, as far as our training was... Yes, it did. As far as our training at Elverton Street was concerned, we used to get lectures from the adjutant, and, of course, our officers were trained more in the tactics than we were. It was a period when the tank corps was changing over from, you might say, Major General Fuller's concept of a tank unit, a tank battalion, which was a light section, a sort of squadron headquarters, and a medium section. And if I remember rightly, the light section was four troops of two tanks each, and that would be about it. And then there was the medium tank, and a close support tank, which was a gun that had a bigger gun in it, it was a howitzer, and it fired smoke. That was the squadron commander's tank. And then behind it came the medium section, which were 5 medium tanks. And the idea was that the light tanks did the reconnaissance. The squadron commander came up, did his reconnaissance, and launched the medium section in whatever type of attack he thought was most suitable on the enemy. And that was sort of Boney Fuller's concept. Well, when the Royal Tank Corps became the Royal Tank Regiment and became a regiment of the Royal Armoured Corps, the tactics were taken over by the Royal Armoured Corps and became very similar to what we sort of this thing is now for armoured regiments and so on. And the tank corps were reckoned to be infantry, what they called infantry tank battalions, which were heavy tanks, although God knows they didn't get anything approaching a heavy tank until the war was practically started. And the cavalry took over the cruiser tank role, which was more reconnaissance and a certain amount of a tank, but they had lighter tanks. These light tanks, as I say, the 1s, 2s, Mark 6s, and these were driven largely by Rolls-Royce or Meadows Vickers engines. You could do about 35, 40 mile an hour in a light tank. When it got going, it could go. We, as the WDs, had some of these rather antiquated tanks to drive down at Farnborough. That's not quite correct. Some were made available to us by the second, and also mediums, and we used to drive those around at weekends. We did the tactical training really took place at annual camp, because we had no facility for doing any, you know, doing anything during the year apart from theoretical stuff on sand tables. Well, in 1936 was the first Tilshead camp. Now, every year the tank brigade used to do, I think, 3 months training on Salisbury Plain. It was based at Tilshead. Now, we, in a word, joined the tank brigade at Tilshead. We had our own camp on one side of the hill, and the tank brigade camp was on the other side of the valley. And what happened in practice was that we were marched over in the morning and we were allocated out to the various tank battalions. And in practice, again, it meant that we just rode around in the tanks and watched what went on, because we were neither qualified nor capable of taking part as a crew member. Not until much later, but obviously the Royal Tank Regiment were more concerned at having its regular drivers on its own tanks rather than let us drive them about and bugger them up. On manoeuvres, the manoeuvres that the tank brigade carried out on the plane, mostly this Boney Fuller's conception or concept of the of how the tanks would be employed, and really it was more manoeuvre than it was actual firing or any. There was no gunnery, didn't come into it, or very little came into it. They were given blank. It was £3 a gun on the mediums. They were given sort of half a dozen blank rounds which they could poop off as and when they wanted, but the tank corps soldier, being like every other soldier, if he fired the gun, it meant the bloody thing had to be cleaned. It made it pretty dirty, so they weren't all that keen on doing it. The novelty had worn off. We rode around on the tanks and, watched what went on. I remember vividly the first time I was allocated to a tank, and we got in the door at the back, like an enormous box with a turret on the top, got inside and off we went. And as soon as they'd left the tank, that was known as riding to attention. As soon as we got out of the tank park, you could ride at ease. And that meant that the crew could get out of the tank and ride on the outside, which was considerably cooler. It was bloody hot inside these things, stinking hot. And I was shattered, because suddenly the chaps who were inside the tank disappeared through a small door, a little door about 18 inches by 18 inches, in the side of the tank. And just outside was the mudguard, only about a foot wide. And they slipped through onto this mudguard and disappeared. And I was sort of left on my tod, except for one chap. And he said, "Well, go on, out you go." I said, "Just a minute, I'd never done it before," shouting sort of the top of my voice. I didn't particularly want to appear to be a coward. On the other hand, I didn't want to be mashed up in the track, because the thing was still, you know, bowling along and rocking and lumping about. And he then showed me how to do it. You sort of slid your body out and sat on this mud guard, and the track was rattling along underneath it, only about an inch below. And you edged your bottom along the mudguard a bit until you got your legs out. And then you stood up and you could get onto the tank. Once you'd done it a couple of times, there was nothing to it. But first time, it was a bit shattering.
This was the exercise, in fact, where you were allocated, each man was allocated to a tank.
To a tank, yes, that is so. But I must be honest that they did make an attempt. Sadly, they gave a fire order and we aimed the gun in the right direction. But I wouldn't really like to say that we were trained as individual members of the tank crew to that intensity, because really the tank corps weren't doing individual crew member training. They were doing manoeuvres more for the benefit of the tank commanders and the officers.
What were they doing, in fact? What kind of manoeuvres were they, in fact, doing?
Well, as I said, it was the light section would go ahead and find the enemy and pin him, as it was called, and they try and, you know, pin him down, working down, get into a hull down position and pin him down. Or alternatively, it could either be other tanks that we were firing, in which case they would try and outmaneuver us. But other cases, they were supposedly batteries of artillery or anti-tank guns you fired at the ants. And the light tank section found them. And then the squadron commander came up in his tank had a look to see where it was, and then ordered a left flank attack or a right flank attack by his medium section, and the medium section came up sort of into a hull down position and in theory shot up the anti-tank gun. Well, that, as I say, that was going. I know I can tell you one story about knocking Hobart's hat off. I was the tank gunner, and one of the things I used to get up to, which was strictly illegal, they used to, firing these blank rounds up a three-pounder, if you put an empty half-pint beer bottle up the gun and fired the blank round, it woofed off with a, you know, sizzled off like a projectile. Highly dangerous thing, but if the chaps were inside the tanks, it didn't make much odds. That was also alternated with handfuls of earth and so forth in rags. And we'd got to the situation where one tank, regular tank or squadron, was facing another regular tank or squadron across, more or less across a road, and they were pooping off these three-pounder blanks as hard as they could go at one another. And I was the gunner, and I was sort of being given the fire orders from the regular tank or crew commander. Anyway, he said, "Fire," and I fired, and I was horrified at that moment because in the telescope I saw the staff car with Major General Hobart go by, and the blast of the gun had knocked his bloody hat right off, and he was naturally furious about this, and he leapt off his car and he slammed this tank or corporal in charge of this thing on a charge, and he was doubled off into the distance back to the camp under close arrest. He never said anything to me, which I was heartily thankful, but it was the commander who got the rollicking.
Did you hear of Hobart much on this exercise?
Well, he was more the controller of the exercises rather than the commander. And he was really training his commanders, if you like, rather than training us. And he would blast about the plane on this sort of staff car. It was an open six-wheel lorry with map boards and seats and so forth in it. A reconnaissance car, I suppose you'd call it, although they didn't have official ones. It was an unofficial thing. And he used to, at the end of the conclusion of any manoeuvre in the day, either the tank commanders were doubled up to hear what he had to say. In some cases, the whole crews had to double up to hear what he had to say. And he addressed them and said what was going right or what was going wrong. And I got the impression he's a pretty fiery individual. Maybe it was this knocking his hat off didn't help him, but he used to give the most imperial rollickings to people for not doing this and that.
Did you ever hear him on the radio?
Well, I can't truthfully say that I heard him, but he used to be pretty concise on that too, what I've heard him. No, I was never. We used to listen in on earphones, but I can't truthfully say I can remember whether it's Hobart speaking or not.
Was he somebody that you discussed at all, his ideas, or had heard of?
Well, the officers might have done, but we didn't. I was interested insofar as reports on the exercises. I was interested to learn. I mean, after all, it was my hobby. It had khaki blood. You know, it was a thing I was interested in. And there were still these reports appearing in the Morning Post, which I read avidly as to what had gone on. And somewhat interesting to find, somebody writing about what you'd actually taken part in. Talking about Major General Hobart, there was the celebrated Bailey Stewart case. Do you know about that? Well, Bailey Stewart was an officer in one of the Scots regiments, was it? Black Watch? Argyles. I think it was a Black Watch. Anyway, he was arrested for spying for the Germans, and he had acquired a copy of the latest tactical doctrines written either by Fuller or Hobart or somebody. The latest tactical tank doctrine, and had flogged it to the Germans. And he was put into the Tower of London, and they had a... He was court-martialed in the Tower. One of the members of the court-martial on the court was Captain Bingham. And a photograph appeared, one of the London papers, the morning papers, I forget which one it was now, but a photograph appeared, Captain Bailey Stewart, the officer in the Tower, and a magnificent photograph of John Bingham walking into the Tower. And he immediately rang up one of the officers who was a solicitor and got formidable damages just on, you know, on the say-so, and that's the point, rightly so, too. That's probably a little piece of history that has got lost.
On those exercises, were you aware of any shortage of equipment?
Well, we were aware of the shortage of equipment to the extent that we thought, God knows, we're never fighting these bloody things. I mean, they were death traps. They only had about a quarter of an inch of armour on them. And some of them were driving about. The armour plate was so expensive that if there was any damage or anything, it was replaced by mild steel. And it used to have a little triangle bolted, a little red triangle with the word mild steel on it, to show that it was mild steel and not armour plate. And we had these same types of tanks issued to us in 39, when I was in the 42nd Royal Tank Regiment Commission. We had a number of these tanks, of which we were expected to repel the Germans had they invaded the country. And they were in an appalling state. And some of the guns were, well, it would have been dangerous to fire them. They'd been cleaned with bath brick and so forth for so many years, they were almost should have been condemned. And the ammunition we had in those days was flat-headed practice shot. Didn't have any pucker ammunition, not for us anyway. And I'm saying that's the state of the parlour, you know, the parlour state that they were in equipment-wise. And that's one of the... I mean, I realised it, and I'm sure I'm quite sure the other chaps realised how badly off we were.
Did these tank corps people that you were in the tank with, did they talk about it? Or what did they talk about?
Well, the sort of story was, well, you know, new tanks are being designed and nobody really knew when the war was going to start. So everybody was hoping that by the time it did start, you know, it would be all right.
What was the state of morale, would you say, with the tank people you met?
Oh, high. You know, the regular army people, as I say, were equipped with, before the war, about a year, 18 months before the war, they were equipped either with the cruiser tanks, the A9 cruiser, or the light tanks Mark VI, which were all right, I suppose, for reconnaissance. The cruisers were a modern concept of tanks, something like an early type of Ballantine. And, of course, the Matilda 2 and the Matilda 1. Matilda 1 was this infantry tank, this thing with the very open tracks and a machine gun in quite heavy armour. And the Matilda was a very good tank indeed, from a thickness of armour point of view, although its armament, its gun, was only a 2-pounder, was puny, you know, in comparison with what it ought to have been and how guns developed later in the war. But until it came up against a really good anti-tank gun, it held its own anywhere. It's the German 88 that finished the Matilda. Went through it like butter.
You mentioned that there were conferences afterwards with Fuller.
Yes.
With Hobart. Mm. Did you actually have to go to conferences with your officers?
Well, yes. If they called everybody up, we went. I mean, I was only a lance corporal in those days. And if it was just tank commanders, well, obviously we didn't go. And many times it was just tank commanders, so we didn't really know what was going on. They were supposed to tell us when it came back again, but sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. It just depends what was going on.
If you went to one, what was the sort of things that were discussed afterwards?
Well, really it was a comment or commentary by, say, somebody like Hobart, who would say that such and such a section... It wasn't in a hull down position and would have been shot up unmercifully, or if they were doing tanky tank stuff, somebody would be caught out in the open and shot to pieces. And or somebody had carried out a particular manoeuvre particularly well, and that was the way to do it, and so on. It wasn't destructive criticism. It was constructive. Of course, this went right out when the cavalry more or less took over, the Royal Armoured Corps took over, if you like. And then it was more a question of a section of tanks, which was either three or four tanks, cooperating with an equivalent unit of infantry, say an infantry platoon or an infantry company, supported by artillery and so on, more cooperation between all arms. And Bernie Fuller's concept was more, you know, tanks and everybody else was inclined to be very much in the background. The cooperation between infantry and tanks was not heard of to any great degree.
Were you working at all? Do you have any recall of working with other arms?
No. The only tank battalion that was doing any infantry tank cooperation was the 4th, and that was the only infantry tank battalion, but we didn't have anything much to do with the 4th at all. They brought out a book, one of these secret books. It was Cooperation Between Tanks and Infantry, and that was published, I think, in end of 1939, beginning of 40. And, of course, it was seized upon avidly by everybody because it was supposed to be the answer to the maiden's prayer, sort of how to do it. And in point of fact, it was diagrammatic. And in fairness to the people that did it, it said this was only sort of an example of how it could be done or one of the ways of doing it. And it pointed out that it was a diagram, and the ground, of course, would make a difference to the actual way it was done. Human nature being what it was, people grasped on these things and thought, well, this is the way you do it, and practiced it more or less in a diagrammatic form. Of course, when they applied this in the Western Desert and places like that, they got shot to buggery. And the actual cooperation of tanks and infantry artillery was forged the hard way almost on the battlefield. And I wouldn't like to say that anybody was taught how to do it. The survivors more or less taught those who came, came on.
One thing about...
It's perhaps a rather hard thing to say, but that's truer than people would like to admit.